Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I had a steamed Chinese bun at Wong in New York that was one of the best things I've put in my mouth. Now, that bun was stuffed with pork belly. Not a surprise. But the honey on the bun and the nubs of coarse salt sprinkled over the honey, that's what made the combo magic. So I tried the honey on biscuits with the salt and black pepper. Very good. Next came honey, coarse salt, and basil on roasting chicken. And even better was making croutons with butter, the salt, the honey, and smoky paprika. Beyond. So stick around. There's a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know what could whip our Congress into shape? A few dinners with Churchill. That's Winston Churchill. The Prime Minister who brought England to victory in World War II. It was a great surprise to Hitler. He'd taken Europe, but couldn't beat down that pesky little island. Well, Churchill accomplished that, partially with his genius at dinner party diplomacy. Some say that his dinners were his most powerful political weapons. What's curious is, though, that volumes have been filled with Churchill's brilliance, but nothing about him and food. Until journalist and Churchill scholar Sita Steltzer unearthed material that nobody had noticed. Well, she's written Dinner with Churchill, Policymaking at the Dinner Table. Sita Steltzer, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you spent 4 years researching Churchill, living and breathing this man. Did you end up actually liking him?
I ended up liking him and having more respect for him than I had expected. I came to like him because I realized from my researches that he was a completely well-rounded human being. I think a lot of people know that he has wit and humor. What they didn't realize and what I had not realized is that he used this on all occasions. I mean, at serious dinners with either President Roosevelt or Marshal Stalin, he could make a joke. He could make a witticism. And he was simply fun to be around. I think, for instance, one of the best examples of his, the reason I like him more as a person, is that he loved picnics. I'd read a lot of history of the Second World War, but I never knew that Churchill loved picnics, and he went on them whenever he could. He had a routine where he would insist on singing Indian Army songs that he'd learned when he was in India as a subaltern. I would have liked to have been sitting next to him on pillows wherever he had a picnic. So he was a completely well-rounded human being.
What was, if you couldn't be at the picnic, what was it like to be at dinner with Churchill? What would the evening have been about?
Well, let's start off by saying that all of Churchill's dinners were working dinners. They had purposes. Let's take as an example a dinner, for instance, during the war at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country house. The evening would have started with guests getting together in the main drawing room, and the guests would have been quite varied. They would have been friends, definitely a family member. There would have been some press people, intelligence officials, generals, admirals, Air Force generals, certainly Americans, probably the American ambassador, and some one or two other maybe French, free French people.
Uh-huh.
They would have started off with champagne about 8:30, no mixed cocktails for Churchill. And then dinner would have gone, moved into the dining room at Checkers, and would have lasted from about 9 to 10 or 10:30. And the menu, because Churchill paid attention to menus and what he wanted to eat was known to everybody throughout his staff. A clear soup, perhaps, turtle soup, maybe consommé. He hated cream soups. He made a fetish of them. Then perhaps a roast chicken, game if it were in season. Fruits and vegetables would have been served. I've never run across a single comment by Churchill on a green vegetable or a salad. Then dessert, by his choice, would have been ice cream, perhaps a little sauce, chocolate sauce. And after that, a pear, some Stilton cheese, which he loved. Now, he would have served his, during the dinner, he would have served his guest red and white wines. He, Churchill himself, would have kept a bottle of champagne by his side so that he could not have to depend on butlers. He could serve himself as he wanted it. And then towards the end of dinner, it would be the time for brandies and cigars. Now, Churchill used his cigars to extend the dinner conversation. Remember, these are working dinners, and the conversation was the most important part of
right.
the dinner rather than the food. So he would have used the slow, ritualistic lighting of a cigar to extend the conversation. And he would have served brandy. Now, early on, a doctor had told Churchill not to drink port because he thought that it would hurt his indigestion. Churchill, with great humor, called his indigestion his Indy. And whenever he referred to it, he was pat his little fat stomach and call and say, I have to worry about my Indy.
Mm-hmm.
But he drank brandy after dinner. That would be about 10:30 or so. He would rejoin the ladies, which was something that was then perfectly acceptable. And they would all watch a movie for an hour and 20 minutes.
A movie,
even during the war.
Huh.
All of them, staff included. And then after the movie, Churchill and the military staff or the secretaries, the principal private secretaries, would get down to work.
Wait a minute. By this time, it's almost midnight.
It's midnight, and Churchill would usually work from midnight until about 2:30.
Huh.
Now, remember, he did have a nap during the day, say between 5 and 7. He would get totally undressed, cover his eyes with a black silk cover and get under his bedclothes and sleep. And that probably gave him a lot more working hours within the day. So he was able to work until 2 or 2:30 in the morning. It was very hard on his staff because they didn't get to nap in the afternoon and they had to be up at 7 and back in Whitehall running the war. It must have been absolutely enchanting to have been at one of Churchill's dinner tables. One guest described how Churchill outlined the naval battle at Jutland, and he had used cutlery to show where the ships were off the coast, and then he used his cigar smoke puffing away to show how the guns would have looked. Another guest described how Churchill outline the battle, some Civil War battles at the dinner table using matches and salt and pepper shakers. So it must have been absolutely riveting to be at a dinner with him. I wish I had been there. But 4 years working with these archives has certainly been a great joy.
You've come as close as you can.
I've come as close as I can, yes.
Sita, thank you.
You're welcome.
Journalist Sita Stelzer is author of Dinner with Churchill. She's a researcher at Churchill College, Cambridge, and a member of the board of the Churchill Center. Well, Churchill loved champagne, so how about a dish that's a natural with anything with bubbles? Jonathan Waxman's apple and chicken liver mousse. And you can have that with a bottle of Churchill's favorite, Paul Roger. Or for a wine that's a tad more attainable, a Spanish cava, like Juve y Camp, Gran Reserva. That's J-U-V-E, the letter Y, and then Camps. CAMPS. It's around $20 a bottle, and it's delicious. The recipe, apple and chicken liver mousse, that's on the website, splendidtable.org. Do you know what's really heartening? It's talking with Jane and Michael Stern. They created the Road Food brand, as in their site, you know, roadfood.com. After decades of eating their way through back roads and small towns, they're still finding mom and pop places that are thriving, in spite of the chains. And luckily, the Sterns share their finds with us. Hey, you two, great to have you back.
Hi, Len.
Hi, Len.
So where have you been?
We have been to Stockholm, Wisconsin, which is along the Mississippi River and that kind of wide spot in the river called Lake Pepin. And in Stockholm, Wisconsin, there is a place called the Stockholm Pie Company. It hasn't been there forever, but it's a place that very quickly in its short life has earned a tremendous reputation among people who really love homestyle pies.
And when they say pies, they mean both pie, you know, dessert pie,
right.
Sour cream apple, my particular favorite, caramel apple crunch, that sort of thing. Ooh. But also the best pot pies. Bacon, pear, and blue cheese pot pie.
Oh, that sounds great.
Could you just pass out from how good that sounds?
That's sort of, why didn't I think of that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sausage, apple, cheddar cheese. Pot pies, I think, almost bloomed like cupcakes did. There was like a sort of a mini pot pie upsurge. But they never quite made it into the realm of the cupcake. But here in Stockholm, Wisconsin, it is absolutely worth the trip if you're a pot pie lover.
But the fact is, most people go for the dessert pies. I in particular fall over backwards over their cream pies. I mean, these are all, needless to say, absolutely from scratch. I mean,
well, it is Wisconsin,
it is,
Michael.
And a butterscotch. You know, butterscotch pies, I mean, 9 out of 10 that you find on the road are made from some kind of pudding mix.
Right.
This is like real butterscotch. I mean, it really has that kind of buttery, kind of caramely richness. It's dense. It's creamy.
It is
topped with freshly whipped, I mean, just whipped cream.
Oh, my.
I mean, not something out of a can. It's like just the kind of pie that you would expect if you were visiting some archetypal farmhouse.
But is this a place where I can kind of sit down and really eat, or is it takeout?
There's a lot of takeout business, no question, but you can sit down. It's a tiny, tiny little restaurant. About half of it is the kitchen. And in fact, I mean, there are a few tables. You know, you order at the counter, carry your own food to a little table or a counter up front. No matter where you sit or even if you're taking food out, you must go to the bathroom at the Stockholm Pie Company.
I beg your pardon.
Even if you don't need to go, you have to go to the bathroom because the bathroom is accessible through the back door. So you leave the restaurant, go into the back door, and once you're in the back door, the hallway to the bathroom leads you past the kitchen. Where you can see them, I mean, literally peeling apples one by one, cutting them up and putting them into pies.
You just look in the kitchen without having to go to the bathroom?
Well, you can go. I'm just head towards the bathroom. Let's put it that way, okay?
You know, what I love about this place is, as Michael said before, it's not an old, old place. It's relatively new, but it is 100% road food. You know, that gets all the check marks of what a great road food restaurant should be.
Oh, and word to the wise, if you are planning to go there and if you love custard pie, call ahead so they can make one for you. It's not part of the daily routine of pies that they make, but if you call ahead, they will make one. And this is one of the great, just pure custard pies anywhere.
And to be polite, you probably have to take the rest of the pie with you.
Well, of course.
And keep it on the back seat in case you get very hungry while you're driving. Right.
Unless you've eaten the entire thing and
sitting. Exactly. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Find their latest picks at splendidtable.org. Well, in our house, it's polenta season, and I've got a version of it that I've never seen mentioned anywhere. You need to try this. It's pure farmhouse food from the Lombardy region of northern Italy. What you see when it's set down in front of you is a dinner plate of steaming polenta. On top, melting butter and Parmigiano. When you fork into it, you discover the polenta hides hot, grilled, tart greens spiked with garlic and lemon. And under them, all cool and creamy, is melting mozzarella. Well, check out the website for polenta hiding greens and mozzarella. Great party food. It's at splendidtable.org. And stay with us for the tricks to vegan baking and Dory Greenspan with that oh-so-French beef on a string. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Beside my desk chair, there's a clutch of books tipped against the bookcase. They're there because I go to them a lot to check facts, get ideas, review techniques. Dory Greenspan's books are usually in the front row. Dory's covered nearly everything in her career. Consummate recipe creator, baker, storyteller, and master of techniques. Which is why it's always fun to talk with her. Dory, good to have you back.
Great to be back with you, Lynn. Thank you.
You know, I was thinking about, because you're always working on some new technique, and I was thinking about poaching. And, you know, we poach fish, we know about poaching chicken, but poaching red meat, that's not something people do.
You know, it's so interesting. I make a dish called beef on a string, and it's a kind of pared-down, I think of it as elegant, version of pot-au-feu. And pot-au-feu is, it comes from the old mettre le pot au feu, put the pot on the fire. And it's essentially a boiled dinner. And I was thinking of it as so French. And then as I was walking over, I'm thinking, well, not so much. New England boiled dinner.
Yeah, corned beef and cabbage.
Corned beef and cabbage, exactly. So I think when we think of putting beef in a pot with liquid, we think of stew. But in fact, we can poach it, and that's it's a gentler technique. And when you make beef on a string, gentle is the word. And what you get is an elegant, elegant meal that you can make for four, you can make for eight, you can make for 20, which is what I did this New Year's Eve.
So, all right, so now the difference between the stewing and the poaching is what?
Well, in the case of beef on a string, it's time. I poach it for a very, very short time.
Uh-huh.
And I think of a stew as being saucy.
Right,
when you're
poaching, right.
Yeah, when you're poaching, you end up with a broth or a bouillon. And traditionally, you would have the bouillon separate from the beef. So it's lighter. To me, everything about poaching is light and gentle and in some ways pure. It's funny to think of poached beef as a light dish, but that's the way I think about it.
Well, so now with you, when you do beef on a string, you're usually using a really tender cut of meat, right?
Exactly, exactly. So it's a splurge dish because it's either a rump steak or a fillet of beef, a tenderloin.
And then you're poaching it to what? Like medium rare? And then out it comes?
Rare, rare, rare. Okay,
ah.
So when you do it in France, you go to the butcher, the guy with that fabulous, you know, apron that goes kind of low cut and to the side.
Yeah,
I think it'd
right.
be sexy.
One shoulder apron.
So
right.
you go to the butcher and you say, I'm making beef on a string. And if he's over the age of 50, he'll know exactly what you're talking about. This is almost a lost recipe. And younger butchers look at me like, huh? What do you want, lady? But the older ones know that they should tie the beef up the way a traditional roast is tied and to leave a very, very long string at the end of it. And that's so that you can put the beef into the poaching liquid and you can lift it out by the string.
I see. Okay, so now take us, just walk us through it.
Okay, you would start by making a bouillon. And I like to start with blackening onions, blackening bones. I put some oxtail in it. And then I deglaze, in a sense. I get up all the goop from the bottom of the stock pot
right.
with some cold water. And then I add vegetables. And it's interesting. When the first time I made it, I tasted the bouillon, and it was good, but not fabulous the way I wanted it to be. And a friend of mine in Paris, a fabulous cook, said to me, you know what you're missing? The beef bouillon cube. And every French cook I've talked to about this dish says the same thing. I just leave you with that. So you make this bouillon, and you can make this 2 days ahead. It's great if you make it ahead. Put it in the refrigerator, chill it. You can take the fat off it. There actually isn't. It's rare that you get a lot of fat in this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discard the vegetables. They've kind of done their job. I have this clear, flavorful bouillon that I'm about to make even more flavorful because I poach my vegetables in it. So I poach them until they're completely cooked, and I put those aside. And that you can do about 2 hours or more before you're serving the dish.
Any vegetable that you want or any variety,
well,
right?
Well, I normally use, in winter, I use small potatoes and onions and carrots and parsnips and celery root, all the root vegetables. But this can be a spring dish as well. And you can use green beans and you can use radishes and you can use, small carrots. You can really play with this dish. And you've already got a root vegetable base, so you've got that flavor. And then when the vegetables are done, I just put them in a bowl with some of the bouillon over it. Then turn up the heat really high. Get that bouillon really, really hot and poach the beef. If you have a filet that's, about 3 inches around or so.
Right.
It really is just 15 minutes.
And that's it.
You want it rare, rare, rare. Take it out, let it rest just a little bit, cut it, and it will be almost, as the French would say, bleu. Blue. And you want it that way because you can now take that beef and serve it to any degree of doneness you want. The way I serve this dish is I put the beef in a shallow soup plate. I put the vegetables around it. And then if I want to keep it that rare, I ladle a little bit of the broth around the beef. If I want it better done, I use the hot broth to flash cook that beef at the last minute.
And so do you serve the bouillon first or do you serve it
all together? Well, I'm very selfish. You're supposed to serve the bouillon as its separate course. But here's what I do. I don't give it to my guests. I give them just enough in the bottom of the soup plate, really, to make everything glistening. And then I save that to serve the following day and the day after as beef vegetable soup. So I can actually get about 3 meals out of this because the leftover beef becomes either sandwiches or a great salad, a beef salad afterwards. But on serving night, just a little bit of broth, it's so flavorful and it makes everything glisten and it's beautiful. And then I serve the traditional condiments that go with pot-au-feu, so horseradish, mustard, both grainy and Dijon, maybe some pickles, coarse salt, and a peppermill. And everybody can play with their food that way and season it and dress it just the way they want.
Perfect party food. Dory, you just rock. Thank you.
Lynn, it's exactly the way I feel about you. Great to be together.
Good to talk to you. Dory Greenspan is author of Around My French Table. Now, for that party dish par excellence, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, dig into our recipe box, sign up for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, and our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there on the website, splendidtable.org. Tuned into the Food Network in January 2012, you may have seen something occur that was unprecedented. Doran Peterson, a baker from Washington, D.C., took home the grand prize on the show Cupcake Wars. What made the victory so remarkable is this. Peterson is a vegan. She runs Sticky Fingers Sweets and Eats Bakery. With that win, she proved to the world that baking without butter, milk, and eggs can give you stunningly good sweets. Reporter Rebecca Shear got to learn how, directly from Doran.
Well, Doran Peterson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to ask about sort of the vegan movement here in the country. I mean, the number of vegan restaurants and bakeries is steadily on the rise, but many people may still resist or just outright dismiss the idea that cooking or baking without animal products can lead to something that actually tastes good. How do you explain to people that vegan baking can indeed be delicious?
Well, I always talk about the science behind baking and how food science is food science. It's not necessarily about the individual ingredients, but it's about the chemistry behind it. And so while there's wonderful qualities to an egg, but there's a reason why it does what it does. And if you can find other ways to get to your end product without using those animal products, then it's going to be the same process and the same chemistry. And so I explain that a little bit in our baking book, how we get there and how we work our recipes kind of backwards, where we'll take a muffin and we know the texture that we really like and the flavors that we want, and we work backwards from there using some of the concepts and techniques and the ways that we've come up with those textures and flavors.
So, for instance, with the egg does what? It kind of...
Everything.
It makes things fluffy, mm-hmm. does some emulsification. So then how do you go about tweaking that in a vegan way to achieve the same results?
Well, you definitely experiment. Over the years, we've experimented a lot. And I did not invent baking without using eggs. There were definitely some recipes out there that I could look to and see how they came up with their end product and how they were getting there. And there's quite a few older recipes from the 1940s, 1950s, where they didn't use eggs and animal products because really they were rationed and even before then, World War II. And it was really easy to find recipes that didn't use eggs in the baking. And we've taken those recipes and worked off of them. So we use chocolate cake recipe that uses baking soda and vinegar. And then the tricky part there is making sure that your flavors are strong enough so that you don't taste baking soda and vinegar.
And vinegar, right.
Have to know how to move away from those flavors that you don't want and pick up the ones you do.
So Doran, when it comes to baking vegan, what is the hardest thing to duplicate, the hardest animal product that you then have to turn into, you know, vegan?
Ugh, that's such a mean question. There are two products that we are constantly working on that we've never gotten to the point where we absolutely love them and we'll serve them to anyone other than us just eating. One is whipped cream. Stable whipped cream is really difficult. We can get a really great, delicious whipped cream, and then after about 10 minutes, it starts to fall apart. The other thing is pot au chaud eclairs. Ugh, it's torture. It never comes out as good as we remember, and it is the bane of our existence, and we will never stop trying.
So one of your big forays into the mainstream, if you will, was your appearance on Cupcake Wars. You actually had two wins on the show, first on a regular episode and then on the All-Stars edition. When you received the call to first go on the show, were you surprised that they'd selected you? I mean, a vegan baker from D.C.?
Well, no. We think of ourselves as a bakery who happens to be vegan. So I think in a mainstream way every day. I don't think of myself, well, we can get away with this because we're vegan, or it's okay if this is this way because we're vegan. Like, no, everything has to be great and everything has to just be stellar, or else we have to be better than everybody else in order to be associated with the people that are maybe not as good as our products, you know, because it is vegan and there is still that little bit of a, you know, a fear that people might have. So when they called me, I was like, I don't want to do it. That sounds crazy. I'm running a shop here. We have stuff to do. We have orders to fill. That's nuts. No way. And then I had watched the show and got a little bit of, you know, anxiety and also just got excited. Like, I like the competition. I thought it would be fun. So Jenny Webb, our head baker, and we shuttled off to LA and we won. And then we had to keep it secret for 3 months. That was torture.
It's the beauty of reality TV.
Totally. That was the worst part. And then we did go back again and did not win. I know, the horrible second time that we went. But then we were invited back again on an All-Star show. And we were dead serious. We did not smile once on that episode. And we won. And it was that for us was really like, you know, proof in the pudding, as they say.
Proof in the vegan pudding.
Vegan pudding.
What was the winning flavor on that episode?
Well, there's four flavors. So the first round for the last episode was a brown sugar cupcake, which I actually have with me here today.
Ooh.
Rum frosting and a brown sugar brittle on top.
So can you maybe hand one over this way?
Absolutely. All yours.
Thanks, Doran. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Shear is producer and host on WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C. Baker Duran Peterson's book is Sticky Fingers Sweets, 100 Super Secret Vegan Recipes. Doran sweetly left us with recipes for two of her cupcakes, The Man in Black, a.k.a. Johnny Cash, and Salt and Pepper. And listen to this. This is a smoked black pepper chocolate cupcake with vanilla bean frosting and smoky salted caramel. I mean, really, you need butter?
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to connect with you. Pick up that phone. 800-537-5252 is how you can get to us. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Linda's on the line from Citrus Heights, California. Linda, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. We're on a very, very tight budget, and I like to cook with wine occasionally.
Right.
And we'll have perhaps a glass of wine with dinner, and I'll have some wine left over. And because it's really a splurge, I don't want to waste the wine. And if I'm not cooking with it right away, can I freeze it? Is there...
Well,
I'm not going to use it in a few weeks.
There are, if you go into wine, you know, liquor stores, wine shops, et cetera, there are these cans. They look like spray cans. And they have no weight to them. They feel like they're empty. And there is a particular gas in that container that is used, been used in restaurants for a very long time. It's odorless, it's tasteless, it's harmless. But it layers a coat of this inert gas over the top of the wine, even if it's a quarter of a bottle, and it keeps air from getting into it because air is what changes wine. And any, you know, and of course, once you've opened the bottle has a lot of air in it. It's sat open, and even if you seal it again, the wine is going to go. Now, right. I try to refrigerate wines because I'm not going to drink it tomorrow, maybe, you know, the wines I've opened. But this inert gas, and I can't remember the name of it, you can buy these cans in just about any place that sells alcohol. And it's a great way to save the wine and save the taste of the wine so you're not going to waste a drop.
Great, great. And in California, I should be able to find out more information.
Oh, if you can't find it in California, something's really wrong.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to be back with more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, let's get back to your questions. The number's 800-537-5252. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see, who are we going to talk to first? We've got Casey calling from Iowa. Casey, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Great to talk to you. Every year about this time, I've got some winter squash in my basement that are getting a little long in the tooth. And this year I've grown three different kinds, and I usually try to make some gnocchi about this time of year.
Right.
You know, it's a good winter food. And I have tried it with different kinds of flour, with eggs, without eggs. And they always, I mean, obviously they end up different. And I wonder if you have some guidelines to tell me how they can turn out, you know, pretty good every time.
Well, generally speaking, depending on the kind, what kind of squash have you got?
This year I grew butternut, acorn, and spaghetti.
Okay. The thing, probably the butternut's going to be the most successful.
Okay.
Because of flavor.
Okay.
The others are very delicate, and the butternut has a more distinctive quality, and it's sweet. The drier the squash, moisture is the enemy of gnocchi. You need some egg as a binder.
You know, that's sort of what's going to hold it together. And the idea is that, for instance, when you're doing the squash, do you roast the squash usually or do you boil it?
I usually roast it in the oven.
Okay, that's great. That's drying it out and that intensifies the flavor as well. And what you want to do is just make sure it's as dry as possible. So, you know, when you take it out of the oven, I always roast it cut side down. Flip it over if you can and let it cool cut side up.
Okay.
Just so you don't have excess moisture. And then the idea, really, gnocchi are always a try it and see what happens kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is true, really, whether you're doing it with potatoes or you're doing it with squash or you're doing it with spinach or ricotta. There's so many variables, your flour, the weather, the whole thing. So this is what I do. Do your basic recipe, whatever one it is that you've liked so far.
Okay.
Pull back on the flour a bit. So let's say if it calls for 2 cups or a cup of flour, pull it back to maybe 2/3 a cup of flour. Because the point with the gnocchi, the tricky thing, you know, that you go for is the flour, only enough flour and egg to hold it together.
Sure.
And that as you simmer it or as you poach it, it holds together, but you get the pure taste of that main ingredient. So do a test gnocco. And this is, you know, I've made these things at the elbows of more Italian women and men than you can shake a stick at. And just about every single one of them does this. And then they might add a bit more flour. But they start out with a minimal amount of flour. Because once you have too much, it's heavy, it's sodden, and you can't take it away.
Right.
But do a test. See how that works. If it falls apart, you know you have to add a bit more flour. And you're home free.
Great.
And a little bit of alcohol in the mix, like just a little bit of vodka or a little bit of white wine, that is going to up the flavor of the squash.
Oh, okay.
Not a lot. A tablespoon,
okay.
Maybe. And some people like to throw some nutmeg in there or some parmigiano with the squash, which is really delicious. That combination is fabulous. And it also makes a wonderful filling, you know, for pasta. But the point is, you can flavor it. Just don't add excess moisture to it.
Okay.
And see see how that works. I think it should help you out.
Thank you much.
You are welcome. Enjoy.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sam is calling from Corvallis, Oregon. Sam, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
What's on your mind?
Well, I listened to your broadcast a while ago with Sandor Katz and his book on the art of fermentation.
Right, the fermentation king. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been trying a few of his recipes, and I finally decided to try sauerkraut.
Uh huh.
And now I just acquired a taste for sauerkraut. And I know it's really good as a garnish, but I'm not quite sure what to do with it besides. And I'm not, if I make a bunch of it, I'm not sure what to do with it. And so I was wondering if you could.
Well, first of all, you know, there's a famous dish that's done in northern France, and it carries over into Germany. It is, a choucroute garnie is what it's called in French. And what it is sauerkraut. Okay, so you make your sauerkraut.
Mm-hmm.
And the sauerkraut is then, you can sauté, for instance, onion and garlic and apple slices. And then the sauerkraut goes into that with white wine and it cooks. So the sauerkraut becomes the bed. And then on top of that, because the area is famous for its sausages and its hams and that kind of thing, you would have simmered sausages and any other cured meat you'd like, but a variety of sausages is just ideal, in beer or in wine. And those go on top. For this time of year, this is the way you feed a mob, because nobody can eat this dish and not feel like they'll never eat again for a week. You know, but the sauerkraut is literally the whole, I mean, it's really garnished with this, and it can, and then you have boiled potatoes, and you can have, and one of the things I always did with it, I don't know if it's traditional or not, but the little sour pickles, the vinegar pickles called cornichon. Well, you can get any good vinegar pickle or any good sourish tart pickle that goes there. You can throw capers over it, boiled carrots. It's this really hearty winter dish, but the sauerkraut is the star. So think about sautéing and flavor bases that the sauerkraut then gets cooked in. You see, follow this. You see, I'll just give you another example. You try a bit of oil, or if you want, bacon fat, or any kind of, even olive oil, a lot of onion, a fair amount of garlic, and then throw in with that whatever herbs you like. Now, for sauerkraut, it's great to do things like thyme and sage and perhaps a bit of marjoram, and then some tomato. And simmer that down just as though you were making a sauce. Then add a lot of sauerkraut to that with some red wine and let that simmer for about a half hour. You're doing this in a skillet. Let that just simmer until all the wine is absorbed and the sauerkraut has absorbed all that flavor.
That sounds very good. Oh, those are some good ideas. Thanks, Lynn.
You are welcome. And enjoy making the sauerkraut.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Bye. The book that Sam mentioned is The Art of Fermentation, and it's by Sandor Katz. And this is the go-to reference for any kind of fermenting, from making pickles to doing your own yogurt to, obviously, sauerkraut. It's a brilliant piece of work. It's something you might want to have in your reference library. 800-537-5252. That's how you can get to us. You can also send us an email at splendidtable.org or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Jessica's on the phone from San Pedro, California. Jessica, what do you want to talk about?
Good morning. After a wonderful afternoon of getting a pedicure and Chinese food, we walked into an international market.
Yeah.
And I was just in a really great space, really great mood, and I decided that I needed to buy these sour cherries, Hungarian pitted sour cherries. And it's been probably 9 months, and I've yet to open the jar because I don't know what to do with them. I looked online. I found a recipe for sour cherry soup.
Right.
That just sounded wrong.
Oh, no. Eastern Europe, you know, Hungary, Romania, all of that area, and going into the Middle East, sour cherries are really prized, and they're used in savory dishes, and they're used in sweets. Now, first of all, sour cherry pie is not to be believed. I mean, this is the true pie cherry. You'd want to drain these because they're in liquid, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you want to drain them, really, really pat them dry. Are they pitted?
Yes.
Okay, that's, yeah, thank God. Okay, so the thing is that's going to make a cherry pie that's what a cherry pie is supposed to be about. But aside from that, to go into the Eastern European traditions, the sour cherry soup, often it's done just with the cherries and white wine that's simmered and the thickening. Sometimes it's done with sour cream. But, oh, yes, sour cherry soup, fabulous, especially in the summer when you serve it cold. Mm-hmm. And it's tangy. It's delicious. Another thing is, for instance, anything that you pan sauté, a piece of fish, almost anything, any protein. What you want to do is, after you remove it from the pan, you know how you have those crumbly bits in the pan?
Yeah.
Drain those sour cherries, give them a rinse, dry them off, throw them in that pan. You can add a bit of garlic, sauté that. And then what you do is you then add to that a bit of white wine, a little bit of, if you want to, Hungarian paprika, and a tad of sour cream. And you scrape up all those nice brown bits once you add the wine and let the wine boil down. And then at the last minute, you stir in that sour cream and you pour that over whatever you have made. You put that over salmon and you'll think you've died and gone to heaven. And
I have some Alaskan salmon in my freezer.
Well, so there you go. There you go. So think any place that you want a tart, fruity punch, those sour cherries are prime. One of the other great things that is done with them, and it's cheating, but you could do this literally with wonton skins, is that they're put into dumplings. They're put into a dough, and they're boiled, and then they're to cook them. And then you put them in with a little bit of cinnamon. If you want to, you can add some something like ricotta, you know, or fresh cheese, and a little bit of nutmeg. And then the idea is you pan brown them in butter until the butter's brown, and you serve those. And they're absolutely unbelievable. Cherry dumplings.
Yum.
Yes. So you've got treasure there. You've got real treasure. And enjoy them.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome, Jessica. Have a ball. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. So, would you let someone come into your house and photograph your refrigerator? Weird, right? But also pretty engaging. The journal Gastronomica had a two-page spread of 12 photos of refrigerators. Their doors open to reveal all. And the only information about them at the bottom of each photo was who the refrigerator belonged to and what they did for a living. I mean, talk about feeling like you're peeping at something that you shouldn't. Some of them made me squirm. Some made me laugh. Some begged to have stories made up about them. Photographer Mark Menjivar took those shots. And these are 12 of the thousand-some fridge photos he's exhibited at museums and universities all over the country. Mark, good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be with you.
So, Mark, you're a photographer. There are so many things in the world you could be shooting. Why refrigerators?
Well, a few years ago, I was working on a documentary with another artist and got really interested in food issues. And being a photographer, I tried photographing all different kinds of things, you know, dining room tables, countertops in the kitchen. And one evening, I walked into the kitchen, opened up the refrigerator door, and was just struck by it, photographed it. And when I got the film back, it was like looking at something that I had never looked at before. I saw a refrigerator in a whole new way.
Well, there are 12 shots here of open refrigerators. Mm-hmm. This is pretty intimate stuff. It's weird to say that about a refrigerator, but how did you get people to let you do this?
Well, a lot of people ask that question. And, you know, over the course of the project, I invited about 80 people to be a part of it. And out of that, only 3 people said no. And so I think a big part was just sharing with people why I was doing the project, my passion for food issues, and really my curiosity, and then inviting them to be a part of that.
What are some of the ones that are particularly intriguing to you?
Well, some of the ones that I think about, I feel like it changes every month, the ones that I think about. Mm-hmm. But there's one of a botanist in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who was really living on the edge of society, experiencing pretty severe mental illness and experiencing food insecurity. So there's very few things in his refrigerator, some hot dog buns, an old Pepsi container holding water, a jar of old chili. And then at the other spectrum, I think about a midwife here in San Antonio that, you know, has a refrigerator just stuffed full of luscious green vegetables from the local farmer's market.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. I mean, the vegetables and the greens are tumbling out. And the note you have on the botanist, you have small captions, says...
Yes, with each one.
He feels far more comfortable among the flora and fauna of his era than people.
He did.
It's kind of very sad.
It is. And with each photograph, there is a little bit of text. There's the person's occupation, where they're from, how many people are in the household, and then some piece of information that I really hope will just be kind of a starting place for the imagination, that it won't be just so literal in thinking about the refrigerator, but that it will really help us each to reflect on our own food.
There's one here that I must say really caught my eye. I think of it as the styrofoam refrigerator. Every space is stuffed with a styrofoam takeout container. Tell me about this person.
There's 18 takeout food containers.
Oh, you counted?
I counted them. Of course I did. And, you know, this guy, he lives basically a reverse life from all of the rest of us. As we're, you know, and our days are winding down, he's waking up and he works in the bar industry. And as all of us are getting up and getting our morning going, he's going to bed. And this refrigerator, Lynn, I got to tell you, I don't tell too many people this, but when I was photographing that refrigerator, it stunk so bad we had to end up closing the door 3 times.
Oh.
But it's interesting. I just went back and re-photographed some of the refrigerators that I did in 2008, now in 2012. And this individual, he was pretty overweight. He's lost over 100 pounds and has completely changed his eating habits.
What does the refrigerator look like now?
Well, all of those takeout food containers have been replaced with fresh foods, vegetables, breads. He completely changed his whole eating habits.
Amazing. So what are you going to do with all of these?
Well, the exhibit, I'm so thankful, has been traveling for the past few years. It's been to about 12 different cities. And in each city, we partner with chefs and farmers and food banks and all different kinds of food organizations to really help people engage in, you know, dialogue about food issues at the local level.
Mark, thank you. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Lynn. I appreciate it.
Mark Menjivar is a photographer based in San Antonio, Texas. His refrigerator photos appeared in the journal Gastronomica. Now, to see his photos, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, while you're there, try one of our favorite refrigerator recipes, chickpea couscous salad with lemon and fresh mint. You know where it is, splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Winston Churchill, who said, "Meeting Franklin Roosevelt was like opening your first bottle of champagne. Knowing him was like drinking it." Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, for additional information on anything you heard here today. You can find information on our latest ebooks, podcasts, rifle through our recipe box, and register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.